absolutely nothing, and no one is going to stop us.
What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
My goodness me, Mark Latham, I've got to change that intro again. Boris is gone.
Another one bites the dust. Oh. Yeah, Boris on the way out, so it's becoming a bit of a curse, Brent, that intro.
It is, isn't it? They say that, I was reading this morning, Mark, they say that it looks like the new leader in the UK will be in their 40s.
Yeah, the candidates who've done well in the first round of balloting are all young, and that'll test them, certainly, at that young age, to try and stabilise the British government, because obviously the Conservative Party are still divided on many issues, most notably Brexit, and Boris Johnson will be hanging around, and I don't think he's going to be all that cooperative. So, yeah, the new leader will need some good people skills.
How quickly we forget, and I shouldn't, you're an expert, you've got a memory, a wonderful memory. What was the last young Prime Minister, one of the youngest they had? What was his
name? The last youngest one. I thought David Cameron was relatively young.
Was it Tony Blair that was really young when he came into power?
Yeah, he might have been mid-40s.
Yeah.
David Cameron, not much older. You go back, there was one called Pitt the Younger 250 years ago. I think he was 25, so they'll never get that young again. But, they've had him old, they've had him young. You know, Winston Churchill was there into his 80s, so they get a variety with varied results.
Well, did you see yesterday on Twitter there was a tit-for-tat between Elon Musk and Donald Trump. They're not on talking terms or speaking terms. There was Elon Musk yesterday questioning the age of Donald Trump, saying he's too old to come back, he's too old to be the president.
Well, what does he say about Biden? He can barely string two words together.
Very
and
true.
Has got into the habit of reading off the auto cue, and if it says, end quote, repeat the line, he reads that out as if it's part of the speech.
I know, wasn't that funny?
You know, neither Biden nor Trump are spring chickens, but I tell you what, Trump, for all his faults, seems to have his marbles in better shape than poor old Joe Biden.
He does. Let's talk about our PM, Anthony Albanese. He's facing his first major international test as PM as he's attempting to negotiate with the Solomon Islands and a climate package and convince Pacific leaders that Australia will remain a valuable security partner in the region. We saw pictures last night everywhere and this morning in the papers of the two leaders having a big hug out. I said they may be hugging out now, but it will be really interesting to see what happens when they all go back to their respective countries and if the affection continues.
Well, I think this is the most important of his overseas trip because he's had plenty of them so far, mainly for the reason there's competition in the Pacific between Australia and the United States on one side and China on the other to win the support and capacity of these small islands. We don't, as Australia, of course, want China to have any form of military capacity stationed on any of the Pacific islands. So it's really about that kind of diplomacy. And at the bottom line, Brent, you've got to say, because some of these island governments are a little bit corrupt, it's about money. So Australia and the United States throw money at them under the banner of climate change. The truth is none of these islands are sinking into the ocean, but the money is there really to say, can you stick with us rather than China? And the Solomon Islands, of course, was a big controversy in the recent federal election campaign. So that's what it's all about, and I hope Albanese is successful. And I think the more often that Petty Wong gets over there and speaks to these island leaders and builds a relationship of trust, Australia benefits from that.
On television this morning, Karl Stefanovic asked the Prime Minister in an interview a question about domestic politics, about here, right? Remembering that he's overseas at the moment, but Anthony Albanese is the Prime Minister of Australia. So Stefanovic asked him a question about domestic politics here. His reply, I couldn't believe it. He said, and I'll paraphrase, but he did say, oh, look, I'm not going to talk about or address domestic politics while I'm here.
Well, I think that's ridiculous. This was something that Bob Hawke tried in the mid-80s. There was a controversy in Australia. I forget the nature of it. It might have been something to do with economic policy. And Hawke was asked about it when he was overseas. I think he might have been in the US. And he said, oh, I don't comment on domestic issues when I'm overseas. And it sort of became known as the Hawke precedent. But it lasted about 5 minutes. Because in a world of instant news and the 24-hour media cycle, and the fact that he's only a couple of hours from Australia and the Pacific Islands, he's not in Washington or London, in a different time zone even. Albanese really should be able to answer about domestic issues, or has he just forgotten about that strange country called Australia
yeah.
that he so infrequently visit.
Absolutely. I was just amazed. I went back and listened again. Did I hear that right? And I did. I did hear what he said. I'm not going to talk about domestic politics here. I thought, yeah, mate, no, it's your job.
No leader since Hawke has tried that on. Not Keating, not Howard or Rudd or Gillard or Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison. Albanese is the first Prime Minister in about 8 or 9 who's trying that on. And you've got to say it's as weak as water.
You know, I was reminded that you had one job. Oh, dear. Let's talk about the New South Wales Top Prosecutor's Office has put out a new guide telling its employees to ask for people's pronouns, claiming it's more correct and inclusive to say someone is assigned male or female at birth, and that there are such people as, wait for it, pansexuals. Now, you've raised the issue with the Attorney General and cited the current Chris Dawson murder trial, saying it was thankful that the prosecutor in that case was not following the guide, because it would have confused matters to be speaking about partners instead of wives. What is a pansexual is my first question.
Attracted to anyone, no matter their gender or sexuality. You know, they find the deep inner meaning of the other person, regardless of how they look. That's what pansexuality is. You know, there's supposed to be about 76 of these classifications now, and that one's become a bit popular. I've never met a pansexual person, and I might never, but I don't know, I suppose, in the substance of this, why the DPP is going down this path. Because when they talk about inclusion, Brent, the DPP, by definition, is an organisation that's supposed to exclude people from society, to get criminals, get a conviction and get them locked up. So it's not an inclusive organisation by definition. The public prosecutor, they stand up in the court arguing this person should be excluded from society because of the crimes they've committed. So this idea of inclusive language is farcical. If the prosecutor in the Dawson case had been talking about partner instead of the allegation, which is you bumped off your first wife so you could get hold of this second one, the young lady from school, or in the Dawson daughters were described not as daughters but as people assigned as female at birth. Well, I think in that case, that language would have been confusing, off target, irrelevant, and the judge there, and if there had been a jury, would have all been scratching their head to say, why is he talking like that when we're talking about someone accused of murdering his wife who had a couple of daughters? So, you know, thankfully the prosecutor there, Craig Everson, didn't follow the rules set out by Sally Dowling, the director of the DPP, and she should consider her position, because this is a complete distraction from their job, which is about excluding people from society and speaking in plain, direct language that's effective as courtroom advocates to win their case.
You said in this article, and you're right, I mean, you accused her of being distracted by woke word games instead of making sure pedophiles don't get out on bail. And haven't we seen too many examples of that happening in recent times?
Yeah, without the DPP appealing the decision and saying this person's a public menace and should be locked up because they're a pedophile. So I'm told that inside the DPP they spent 5 years working on this word control booklet, set of rules, instead of doing their real job. They've been doing this since 2017, instead of putting their heads down to effectively lock up pedophiles, rapists, murderers, and ensure that the public's got confidence in the role of the DPP, which is funded with many, many millions of dollars each year. So this is, you know, there's a lot of these ridiculous PC instruments out there. I think this is the most bizarre of the lot.
I tell you what, these days you pick up a story and nothing surprises you, does it? Nothing surprises you.
Well, it doesn't say in the Dawson case, the judge said, well, you prosecutor, you're using all these terms like a person assigned as female at birth, and I found your presentation to be a bit confusing in that regard. It actually weakens the role they're funded to perform, which is very important, that Dawson, if he was a murderer, he belongs in jail. But if they can't express themselves in language that impresses the court and is understood, why are we funding the DPP? Can we get someone else than this Sally Dowling, who must be an absolute dill?
OK. The New South Wales Corruption Watchdog is considering whether to investigate the circumstances in which John Barilaro was appointed to this US trade post. We had what's the paper say? The inquiry heard explosive claims this week. Do you think this will end up in ICAC?
Well, they've referred it. The committee from the upper house has referred the transcript to ICAC. They'll have a look at it. They might do some interviews behind the scenes. But
right.
At this stage, it hasn't sort of percolated into evidence of wrongdoing or I suppose there's a stuff-up, but not evidence of wrongdoing at ministerial level. But what we've got essentially is Amy Brown, the head of Investment New South Wales, in a she-said versus she-said with Jenny West, who originally was told under Gladys Berejiklian she'd get this New York posting. And Amy Brown, apparently in closed session, made allegations against Jenny West that her CV had been manipulated, that her diary, she was goofing off, not doing her job. And Jenny West came to the committee and said she rejects those allegations. They were never raised with her by Amy Brown, which seems strange. And she dropped the bombshell that Amy Brown said to her, "You're not getting the job. It's a present for someone else." Now, we don't know who's supposed to have said that. Stuart Ayres denies it. All you can say, Brent, is this Barilaro thing has become a massive dog's breakfast, very confusing, very messy, and at the end of the day, we may never find out exactly what went on other than it was a stuff-up.
And all it has done successfully for the Perrottet government is it'll cost them votes in March next year, absolutely.
Yeah, well, the strange thing was that the Friday before the budget, the state budget, big spending state budget, huge debt and deficit, goodies for everyone, that was on the Tuesday. Stuart Ayres announced the appointment on the Friday. So what's that, 4 days earlier? Maybe thought the appointment would be buried under the news about the budget, but the opposite happened. They buried the budget under their own Barilaro appointment, and the scandal and the controversy has run in the media ever since. So it's very hard to understand what went on. The Liberal Party in state parliament, I can tell you, works in very strange ways, and this is one of them.
New South Wales disappointed with the result last night in the state of origin, but speaking of politics, I see there was a story around today that said the New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet did the bolt from the stadium 15 minutes early. So he probably thought, well, this is not going to end well. I'll get out of here.
That's Bob Carr-esque. Bob Carr used to leave the football at half time, thinking it was full time. They did that once at Parramatta Stadium, and his staff had to haul him back and say, "Bob, where are you going?" He said, "They walked off the field. It must be over." They said, "No, Bob, that's only half time. They have a 10-minute break. They come back for a second half." And he said, "Oh, no, I can't bear to watch another 40 minutes of that." And they said, "Bob, we're in the middle of the Parramatta by-election. If you keep walking and get in your car, we can kiss the by-election goodbye." So he had to go back and watch the second half. Perrottet left 15 minutes early. The game was still alive then. New South Wales weren't that far behind. It would have been, what, 16-12 at that time? I find that extraordinary that he'd leave early. But in the substance of the match, Brent, and you're a footy fan, it was one of the best games I've ever seen. It had everything. It was an epic contest with passion, power, strength, skill, the Ben Hunt redemption story, Queensland win, even though we don't like the results, you'd have to say Queensland were the better team.
They were.
Winning against the odds, playing with just 15 people after a couple of minutes, it was phenomenal.
And don't you love it when you get a result like this and you say, well, they deserve to win. They played well, they deserve to win, but so did New South Wales. They played well. It was just a really good game all around for both sides.
Oh, yeah, people like Eric Grace Jr. are on Twitter, I see, saying it's the best game of rugby league ever played. And it may well be. It obviously, you're cheering for New South Wales. You're a bit disappointed with the result. But I felt it was a privilege to watch a contest of that nature, which was gripping, entertaining. It had everything. And, you know, anyone who doesn't enjoy a match like that, well, they're obviously not a footy fan. But it was something that was very, very special, and we'll always remember it, even though the result was not what we wanted.
Just before I let you go, we've been talking about this morning. Question without notice, Mark. This is the animal rights uproar as kids. The headline says, "Animal rights uproar as kids to join hunt in New South Wales. Children under the age of 12 could be hunting game with bows and dogs under a sweeping reform of New South Wales hunting laws, a move animal rights groups have condemned as watering down restrictions on blood sport." Have you got any thoughts on this, Mark?
Well, the animal welfare people complain about a lot of things. In truth, animals in our society, particularly domestic pets, have never been treated so lavishly. You know, the pets are in some houses doing better than the humans, the treatment they get. I don't know if there's a law change that's allowing bows and arrows, but I think the idea that 12-year-olds are going to be out there like Robin Hood with a bow and arrow is far-fetched, isn't it? I just don't think that would be happening. And the animal welfare people plant a lot of stories in the media, whether this one's true or not. It certainly hasn't come up in legislation at the New South Wales Upper House, and it sounds a bit fanciful to me.
Okay. Did you know, by the way, that last year you were saying that, you know, some animals live better than people in their homes? Do you know that Australians, households, we spent last year on our pets $12.2 billion.
Really? $12.2 billion?
Billion, not million.
Wow.
Billion
well,
dollars.
A part of it is COVID. A lot more pets were purchased.
Yes.
In lockdown, it was great to have a pet around. And these days, the pets, you know, I know our two dogs here are cooked fresh fresh meat, kangaroo meat, chicken, mince, you know, a standard that some humans would like to eat. They're cooked up, they sleep inside on beds, they're cuddled like humans. One of our dogs, we call it the hoo-hoo dog, because it's a human dog. It thinks it sits up to get cuddled like a baby. And they live a wonderful life, and that is a great improved standard. I know there's some idiots out there still with animal cruelty, but I think that's fading in society, which is a good thing.
It's always good to talk to you. Thank you for giving us your time this morning. We're back to afternoons next week, so I'll catch up with you next Thursday afternoon, Mark.
A pleasure. Thanks, Brent.
Thanks,
all
mate.
The best.
Bye-bye.